Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, his latest book is called The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. Dr. Gabor Mate joins us on Turning Pages. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Mate.
Thank you. Nice to be with you again.
In the pull quotes at the beginning of this book, Julie Holland refers to this as your magnum opus. And I'm curious, because this book does seem to pull threads from several of your previous books, do you kind of view this as kind of the culmination or some sort of apotheosis of your work up to this point?
Well, the book both pulls but also expands on my previous work. I've talked about addiction before, of course. I've talked about physical health and the relationship to stress. I've talked about child raising before. I've not so much talked about how mental health and physical health are both related to childhood trauma and to stresses. And I've not looked at the broader social picture in the way that I have here. So what I'm saying in this book is that human beings are creatures of connection and community, where our physical and mental health depends on the kind of context and environment that we live in, and that this culture provides a very unhealthy template for human life.
The decision to wrap that all up together, rather than kind of examining individual things as you've done in the past, did that come about like kind of your own personal trajectory, or like was there a precipitating instance that made you think, oh, I want to address this in this way?
Well, it comes both of my own personal predisposition to look at the broader picture. I've always been sort of the systemic thinker who wanted to look at the whole picture, and I was like that even before I went to medical school. But what has also become apparent is that the crisis in terms of health in our culture is increasing, and the science that shows the unity of mind, body, and social existence, the inseparableness of our biology from our emotional and social and therefore cultural lives, has become so well documented. The science is so clear and so eloquent, and yet it's so ignored in medical training and medical practice, that I just have to write something that brings it all together.
Yeah, you refer in the book to humans as being biopsychosocial.
Biopsychosocial, if I can put it that way. Biopsychosocial, which means that our biology is inseparable from our social relationships and our emotional lives.
Now, you mentioned, you know, like doing readings, and there's scientific research and studies related in the book. Is this something, you know, as a physician who, you know, is reading the journals, or is this something that you kind of glom onto different things that touch upon these topics just as an interested reader? Like, because there's, I mean, obviously a great deal of endnotes. There's a lot of research in this book, but you pull from public figures, interviews, you pull from novels as well. Like there's a lot of stuff kind of here to fuel your argument. I'm curious about kind of like the research process, and whether it's just an ongoing thing that you're always kind of making notation of things that kind of touch on this.
You know, whenever I read a good novel, when I read a novel, if I run across a citation that appeals to me, I dictate it to my cell phone or I copy it out. I pull from everything. But that's just the whole point. The whole point is that it is all one, that our cultural lives and our emotions and our thoughts and our human relationships and our social structures and the way we make our living and the way we raise our children, the way we think about life itself, the way we relate to ourselves, this is all one unit. They all affect each other. They all have an impact on each other. They're all manifestations of a process that we're all a part of. That's my whole point in this book.
Well, and as you detail in the book, that pushes against kind of the atomized, like individualistic notions of capitalist democracy, right? That like individual actors and separating things out and parsing people.
Well, every society, I'm sorry, did you complete the question?
No, go ahead. Sorry, yes.
Yeah, that's okay. Every society has certain assumptions about human nature. And they usually make that assumptions based on how they function. But let me give you a dramatic example. You could look at an elephant and conclude that an elephant is a creature that lies around the whole day, gets up every once in a while, walks around a bit, eats, and then lies down again. You could make that assumption if you studied elephants in a zoo. But what if you studied elephants in a natural habitat? Your sense of what an elephant is and what an elephant's nature is would be very, very different. And our society makes certain assumptions based about human nature, based on how we function in this particular context. So our assumption about human nature is that we're selfish, aggressive, competitive, grasping creatures. And when somebody does something selfish or manipulative, what do we say? We say, well, that's just human nature. But when somebody does something generous and collaborative and kind and open-hearted, do we say, oh, that's just human nature? And yet, that second is more close to human nature as nature intended it than the first, because we evolved for millions of years as communal, collaborative creatures. We could not have existed otherwise. So evolution depended on not this rugged individualistic ethic that we're all separate and individual and hostile and competitive, but in fact that we're collaborative and connected. And if you look at the indigenous societies and Aboriginal societies, that's still how they live when we've left them alone, when we've destroyed their societies. Unfortunately, the result is severe trauma. But the point is, we can't make assumptions about human beings just by studying them in one particular artificial culture.
Do you think the dismissiveness in that example you used, of the sort of the behaviors and sort of writing them off, the dismissiveness of the former and the kind of like neglect of the latter, is that just because it reinforces kind of the existing structure?
Well, that for sure, it does reinforce the existing structure because it justifies everything. But it also reflects the fact that the way we live our lives, we create people like that. In other words, we by the way we raise children and the values that we inculcate and the way people are made to work and exist, it reinforces that sense that we're separate and isolated and competitive. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy is what it is.
Right. That gets me to the section on politics, because you do talk about how essentially we elect leaders who reinforce the status quo and create further inequities that then reinforce the status quo. That like that they are elected because they're successful in a broken system and they continue to break that system or at least ensure that system remains broken.
Well, I would first of all intervene right away and say it's not broken. It's working very well for some people. For example, during COVID, the billionaire class in Canada, as internationally, gained billions more. You can't say that the system is broken for them. It's working for them. So it's a question of from what point of view do we consider the system broken?
Right.
From the point of view of the people that profit from it and who largely control it and who have the greatest influence on our politics and our economics and our social life, it's working very well. Now, they may not be individually truly happy, but in terms of how they define success, it's really working for them. Now,
So
it's also true, as you were saying, that in this society, then the kind of people we tend to elect to power are power hungry. Why are they power hungry? Because they don't feel enough themselves that they're okay just the way they are. So they cling to power. And I gave examples in a book, both from Canada and the US, of in very recent leaders having suffered significant childhood trauma. And that shows up in their politics. And this is what, no matter what side of the spectrum you're looking at. So I'm not being, when I look at Trump, I also look at Hillary Clinton. If I look at Justin Trudeau, I also look at Stephen Harper. And often when you look at these people, they suffer significant trauma, which shows up in their way they practice politics.
now, you mentioned, obviously the system is working in the sense that it's, enriching billionaires but in terms of politics, is it because we see in our other in the other leaders ourselves that we then choose to elect them, or is it that the system kind of perpetuates this like election of broken people? Like, is there a way out of that portion of things at
Well,
system?
I don't provide political solutions in this book, and I'm not sure that I'm in a position to do that. but I do point out that These are the people that get elected to power, and then they keep the system going. And their own traumas contributed that a fair bit. You know, again, this, I'm not choosing political sides here. I'm saying this is true across the board.
Right. And I'm not asking you to like pick a side in that. I'm just wondering if there's a way out of electing broken people. But you mentioned in the book a physician named Rudolf Virchow, who practiced in Berlin, who said, you know, medicine is a social science and politics is nothing else but medicine on a large scale.
Yeah.
You know, when did you come across Virchow, and like how much did that impact writing that sort of portion of this book?
You know, that's what's interesting, is that I was writing this book. I came across all these physicians throughout the ages, like Canada's William Osler, who recognized the relationship between mind and body and emotions and physiology, or Virchow, who in Germany in the 19th century recognized the inextricable link between politics and people's health and population health. It's not so much that they influenced my work, is that in researching the book, I found that there were all these giants of medicine saying these things all along. And that's what makes it so frustrating, is that we have Osler, we have Hans Selye, who did the work on stress right here in Canada. We have Virchow in Germany. We have many others. And yet their historical contributions, their names are recognized as great leaders in medicine, but what they taught is completely ignored. That's what was so interesting in writing this book, is finding these pioneers who saw all these things long before we had the modern science to prove it, but whose teachings are still not, they're respected, but their teachings are totally forgotten.
Do you worry about that within your own books? I mean, it's been ages since you wrote, you know, All Hungry Ghosts. Like, do you, and I mean, right here in Manitoba, like our provincial government is just adamant against safer consumption sites and about, you know, treating people who use drugs in a appropriate way. Mm-hmm. Like, did you worry about kind of like the impact your arguments have versus, you know, your own role?
I'm trying to understand your question. Did I worry about my...
Like, do you consider, like, are you frustrated at all by, like, arguments that you've been making for over a decade not necessarily showing any kind of salience, or at least like on the political class sinking in? Like, people know the name Gabor Mate, but do they understand the lesson you taught in a book a decade ago?
I mean, I got the Order of Canada, you know, and I wish they would take away the Order of Canada and practice what I'm actually teaching, you know. Mm-hmm. It's nice to be personally recognized, but it's frustrating that the science, and it's not just personal to me, I mean, a lot of people have recognized the link between trauma and addiction, for example. But it'd be very nice, never mind, it's nice to get this private personal recognition. It'd be even nicer if the politicians actually looked at the science and practiced it. And that's beginning to happen. And I know that my work has made quite a difference in the addiction world, but not enough. The average medical student still doesn't get a single lecture on a relationship between addictions and trauma. None, which is astonishing, given all the science. They don't get a single lecture on a relationship between emotional stress and physical health, which is astonishing given all the science. They don't get a lecture. There's a British psychologist who said, a very famous one, who said that the link between childhood adversity and adult mental illness is as well established as the link between smoking and lung cancer, but the average medical student doesn't get a single lecture about it. And so it's frustrating. If I allowed myself to get frustrated, I'd be very frustrated, but I don't. I just keep doing the work and hoping that the world will catch up.
That separation between, you know, what they're instructed and the linkages that's been proven, you detail that, because you talk about, you know, in giving some real life examples of some people that, like, their physician didn't ask them about these things, that, like, it never came up.
Yeah.
You know, they're just treating the specific symptoms and not the, like, underlying problems.
I could give you three examples. William Osler, who I've mentioned, the great Canadian physician, Sir William Osler, saw in 1890 that rheumatoid arthritis was a disease driven by stress. He said that. The person who first described multiple sclerosis, French neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot, towards the middle of the 19th century. He said that this is a disease driven by stress. James Paget, a British surgeon, in 1870, wrote that breast cancer was related to women's emotional lives. And yet, these teachings are not, you know, again, I keep saying that science keeps proving it, keeps proving that the wisdom of what they said over 100 years ago, but medical practice still totally ignores it. And there's all kinds of reasons why that is the case. Part of which is the fact that a lot of doctors are themselves very traumatized, but they just haven't dealt with their trauma. Medical education for a lot of people is highly traumatized. So therefore, when a person shows up to a neurologist's office with multiple sclerosis, despite all the research showing the relationship between childhood trauma, adult stress, and multiple sclerosis, the average neurologist hasn't got a clue. So the person goes to them, they get the physical treatment, which is great, but nobody talks to them about the emotional stresses, which if they addressed, could actually have a positive impact on their illness. So it's a really sad dichotomy between reality and medical practice.
There seems to be an argument to make that, you know, the way that we treat disease is part of this, that, you know, we look at it as an atomized thing in and of itself, separate right. from the person and from their life. And in the same way that we were talking earlier about, you know, kind of like viewing the individual as atomized from society, that maybe it's the same kind of problem and approach.
Would you just say that again, please?
The way that we look at illness, you know, we atomize disease. Yeah. We treat it as an individual thing separate yeah. from the person and kind of the underlying life. We do the same with, you know, a person within a society, and whether, you know, that disconnect is part of the problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Johann Hari, the British writer, wrote a book on depression called Lost Connections, pointing out the relationship between the lost social connections and the rise of depression in society. I addressed the same issue. And just as Western medicine looks at, say, multiple sclerosis as an isolated disease of the nervous system for which we don't know the cause, when we actually look at a person's life and see that the emotional processes that stress the individual that then results in the multiple sclerosis is actually related to the person's whole life. So that is not just an isolated disease, isolated pathology in a single organ. We're looking at the manifestations of a person's entire life. It's the same with when society looks at an individual, say, with addiction. We say, well, there's a person who's making bad choices or got this unfortunate genetic disease. No, they don't. What they have is the response to trauma that affected them, which is why, by the way, if you look at two conditions, addictions, say, or rheumatoid arthritis, who's got the highest rates in our society? Indigenous people. Why? Because they're the most traumatized segment of our population because of Canadian history, Canadian policy, and that's an ongoing problem. And who's got the highest rates of rheumatoid arthritis? Indigenous women. Why? Because women take on more stress in this culture, as I pointed in this book, and because they're indigenous. So that, what if we saw the rheumatoid arthritis in our indigenous female population or in the whole population in general, not as an isolated disease in person's joints, but as a manifestation of their whole lives in a particular culture? Now we could really deal with it.
Right. You talk at one point about, you know, women very often serve as an emotional connective tissue within their
right
social groups, and that it's interesting that they have the larger issue of, you know, connective tissue issues in the body as well, that, you know, it manifests itself that way.
Well, exactly. So that medicine claims itself to be ignorant about why is it that women have 70 or 80% of autoimmune disease. But if you understand the relationship between emotions and stress, and if you see that culturally in this society, women are expected to take on the emotional stresses, of their families and their spouses, and they're acculturated to ignore their own needs in favor of supporting the needs of others, and even feeling guilty if others are suffering stress. Like during COVID, there was a study that showed that women tried to take on the stresses of their spouses and their families, and when they weren't successful in alleviating them, they felt guilty. Well, that stress on women to take on the, be the connective tissue, as you say, of their families and their communities, shows up in the connective tissue diseases because it's they're taking on too much, and they're not, and they're being acculturated to ignore their own needs for the sake of meeting the needs of others.
Well, speaking of women taking on too much, you do talk about, you know, the gestational health and yeah. how a woman is in when she's pregnant, and then the impact on a child, and that it seems to be a real strong argument for better supports for pregnant women.
Absolutely. So when I was trained in medical school, you know, when it came to prenatal care, I was trained to ask all the right questions about diet and, you know, check the weight and check the blood pressure and check the baby's growth and all that. Nobody ever asked me to talk. Nobody ever taught me to talk to women about their emotional health. And yet now we know from multiple studies that a woman's emotional stresses while she's carrying the infant can have an impact on a child's brain development and future emotional health. So that if we looked after pregnant women in a more humane and more holistic fashion, we could actually help to promote or prevent some or mitigate the risk for certain childhood emotional or mental health conditions. Then is the question of how we deliver babies. So I was taught to deliver babies in a very mechanized, medicalized way. Western medicine has made great contributions and saves lots of lives because of our capacity to intervene when necessary. But we're also intervening when it's not necessary, so that the cesarean section rate in my own province in British Columbia is approaching 40% now, which means we've mechanized the natural process, which interferes with the natural bonding between mother and infant. So there's so much that we could be appreciating in terms of the achievements of Western medicine, but we've gone way overboard. And again, we've lost the sense of the wholeness of human beings.
Yeah, you provide some startling examples from a couple of people who had cesarean pregnancies, you know, against their wishes, or at least, you know, within yeah. a context that was harmful and created issues early in their parenthood journey.
Yes, the cesarean section can be life-saving for mother and infant, and it should be employed, according to the best estimates, in about 10 to 15% of cases. Mm-hmm. When you get to a rate of 40%, or in some countries now, especially in the more educated classes, it's now 50%. That's a deep interference with an evolution-derived process that nature created. And that was necessary, not just to extract the baby from the womb, but to promote the bonding between mother and infant. Mm-hmm. And we're interfering with that wholesale. That has impacts.
One last topic I wanted to touch on, just because you do push against kind of general ideas of around it, is genetic predisposition.
Yeah.
And that,
well, sure. So there's the genetic disease that runs in my family, which means if you have the gene, you'll have the disease. It's multiple sclerosis. My mother had the gene. My aunt had it. They both died with it. I mean, it shortened their lives, and it made their lives much more difficult. Very few diseases like that are genetically determined. For the most part, when we think that diseases are genetic, they actually are not, or the genetic contribution is relatively small. And what really matters is how the environment acts on the genes. So for example, although it's generally believed that addictions are genetic, they're not. Nobody's ever found a single gene for addiction. Nobody's ever found a group of genes that if you have them, you'll be addicted, or if you don't have them, you won't be. Now, there are some genes that predispose. That means that if you have the genes, and if the environment acts on you in a certain way, you're more likely to have a certain condition. But that's not the same as a predetermination. It also means that people with the same genes, depending on what their environment gives them, they can either be very healthy or very ill with the same genes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a big book with a lot to unpack, more than we have time for. But Dr. Gebremate, I want to thank you very much for taking some time to talk about it today.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to do so. Thank you.